Are police too militarized? That's today's big question. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 7.5 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Wednesday, August 20th. We will hear from two guests who have different views on today's big question in separate half hours, and we will welcome your questions too and your views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. As you know, Ferguson, Missouri police were criticized for using excessive force and military-style gear on protesters after the police shooting death of an unarmed black teenager. Meanwhile, a House Democrat is planning on introducing a bill aimed at demilitarizing local police. And we'll talk about it. We do have stories in Wisconsin as well that police in Wisconsin have received some of this military gear, including armored vehicles, and have justified it as equipment that can be used to protect police and the public. Let me welcome our first guest. Nick Gillespie is the editor-in-chief at Reason.com and Reason TV. He is the co-author of The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. He's also a columnist for the Daily Beast and Time. Good morning.
Thanks for having me, John. Yeah.
So are police too militarized in this country?
Yeah, well, let's break it down a little bit. There is no question that there has, you know, first off, I think everybody in law enforcement recognizes a distinction between kind of, you know, what basic law enforcement is supposed to be about in police work and military occupation or military style actions. And they have very different aims, and they, you know, really belong to very different sets of law enforcement, I think. There's also no question that over the past 40 years or so, that the rise of paramilitary operations within, you know, local police departments, and that can be anything from the NYPD or the LAPD, which really pioneered the use of SWAT teams, to small towns like Ferguson or Keene, New Hampshire, or whatever, have gotten increasing amounts of militarized gear. And started using militarized tactics. You know, SWAT teams, which grew out of incidents, mostly hostage incidents in the late 60s, were supposed to be designed. Special weapons and tactics were going to be used mostly in hostage situations. Now, by most accounts, you know, there are thousands of SWAT teams at every level of police department in America, and something like only 7% of SWAT raids are actually used in anything resembling a hostage or standoff situation. The rest are used for kind of run-of-the-mill delivering of warrants and of arrests, you know, requests and things like that.
Well, what's the harm in police having military-style body armor, assault rifles, armored vehicles? What's the harm in that?
You know, part of it is that the gear does not come kind of unattached from a set of expectations and a kind of temperament and mindset, and that so that at the same time that we've seen in various communities increases or rather decreases in crime when police adopt community policing models, which are really not about dealing with the local populations as kind of an occupying military force, but rather engaging them and interacting with them and actually becoming part of the, you know, the fabric of the local community. At the same time, we've seen that and big successes with that. We've also seen things where, you know, if you start suiting up like a, you know, a kind of Star Wars Imperial trooper, stormtrooper, you're going to act like that more. And, you know, there's something like 40,000 raids a year, by some estimates in America, of kind of paramilitary raids to serve warrants and to break into buildings again. You know, that comes at a real cost, and we see that in something like Ferguson, not even necessarily in the original incident, the Michael Brown shooting, but then in the response to it by local police, where it's to act very ham-fisted and to actually increase the problems. Or there was a county in Georgia Just a couple of weeks ago, we covered this story extensively on Reason, and unfortunately, it's very typical where during a no-knock raid to, supposedly search a house for drugs, in which, of course, no drugs were found, the cops came on in the middle of the night, and they threw flashbang grenades, which are, you know, explosive devices that are supposed to kind of disorient and blind people momentarily. They ended up badly burning a baby, a toddler, and for no reason. That's the problem, is that if you give somebody a semi-automatic rifle and if you give them body armor and you give them a tank and you tell them that they are military, not cops, they're going to act like military, and that's not what local law enforcement is supposed to be doing, and it really ends up causing more problems than it solves.
Help us understand how this happened. How did local police departments start getting all of these tactics and this equipment?
Yeah, I think it's partly in the late '60s. There were a number of kind of terrorist hostage situations, involving groups like the Weather Underground and whatnot, and the Symbionese Liberation Army. There were a lot of bombings. There was a lot of terrorist activity at the local level throughout the late '60s and early '70s, and that called for a response. I mean, people like Daryl Gates, who ended up leaving, being the police chief of the LAPD. During the Rodney King riots, he was instrumental in creating a kind of what has become known as the kind of special, the SWAT team, the kind of paramilitary, the exemplum of a paramilitary force. And the idea was that we were at a war, the war had come home and we needed to be able to fight that. Later, during the 70s and especially the 80s, as the war on drugs started cropping up and becoming more of a battleground, cops felt that they were outgunned and out-armored by drug dealers, and so the federal government started making available more and more kind of military-style and military-grade weaponry for local police departments. And then after 9/11, this was a big part of Department of Homeland Security, and there were a number of federal programs that started taking excess or unused Pentagon equipment and actually sending it to local police departments. And there are all sorts of places where you can see this coming up. You were mentioning some small towns in Wisconsin or counties in Wisconsin. I mean, that's happened virtually everywhere, especially in the rush right after 9/11. Virtually every police department and even fire departments and stuff like that had access to, a wide variety of military or militarized kind of weaponry and body armor and other types of vehicles.
So you you would be in favor of this proposal? This lawmaker is planning on introducing a bill in Congress that would stop the Pentagon from distributing this surplus equipment?
Yeah, in broad terms, I haven't read the legislation, so I don't know, exactly what's in it and whatnot. And the point here is not to say that, the police are bad and that they need to, start coddling criminals or anything like that. It's not that at all. We've had a remarkable drop in the rate of violent crime in America since about the mid-90s, which ironically was a time when everybody, all criminologists, were predicting massive spikes in what they called the super predators and really violent crime. But the reason for that decline, which is something of a mystery, is not predicated upon terrorizing, or it should not be predicated upon terrorizing local populations through paramilitary tactics. The one of the real issues here, and I recently interviewed Bernie Kerik, who is the former police commissioner of the city of New York, and he was actually nominated to succeed Tom Ridge as the second secretary of the Homeland Security until a bunch of personal scandals ruined his chances. But he was saying, he lives in a small town in suburban New Jersey, and that within that county there are dozens of local police departments, all of whom have various kinds of gear that they're simply not trained for, or they don't know how to use properly, and so that you can't give people really powerful weaponry and really powerful armor and really powerful vehicles and then expect them to be able to use those in the most judicious and wise way possible.
Yeah, but what do you say, though, to those police agencies, law enforcement agencies that would say, You know, the criminals have assault rifles and all sorts of, they're heavily armed. We need to be heavily armed, too.
First off, that is oftentimes an exaggeration. Not always, but, you know, there are places where, you know, in certain types of cities and in certain types of rural areas where there are, you know, widely understood or, you know, either criminal enterprises, you know, organized crime or really, high-powered criminal entities, yeah, you need that. And you also need to be coordinating across jurisdictions so that it's not simply the local police of a small town. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, think of a place like Ferguson. We are not talking about we're talking about an area that has had endemic poverty and a fair amount of crime, but it is not, you know, the criminals there are not carrying, semi-automatic weapons. They are not carrying grenades. They are not carrying grenade launchers. There's nothing like that. And that is far more typical. And even in big cities, most of the time, the guns and weaponry that is used in crime is not of the semi-automatic variety or anything like that. We've seen, you know, this kind of threat inflation broadly defined across America, especially since 9/11. I mean, it's always there in the national conversation. You know, the way that you get resources is by pumping up whatever threat or whatever problem you say you're facing. But since 9/11, we have, you know, we've seen just ludicrous amounts of money and hardware going to protect us from terrorism, to protect us from super criminals that simply don't exist or are directed to, you know, weird positions. In the wake of 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security basically had a blank check to give to every community in America, you know, that they became terrorists, you know, put their potential terrorist targets. So, yeah, you should get whatever you need because it ultimately was a political calculation. It was not a criminological one whatsoever.
We are talking with Nick Gillespie, editor-in-chief at Reason.com and Reason TV, about today's big question. Are law enforcement agencies too heavily armed for everyday policing? Do local police really need military-style equipment as they have received from this Pentagon program? What do you think? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with a guest about today's big question: are local police too militarized? Should they be demilitarized? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to the phones. Barb in Door County is with us. Hello, Barb.
Hello, Joy. I was just calling in because recently I was in Sturgeon Bay and a businessman there told me that the Door County Police purchased 2 armored vehicles for Door County. And anyone who's been there realizes it's a small resort community. And there, my dad always said that the police up here said that there's only one way out, Highway 57. So the police could very easily in the past, you know, get a criminal if they needed to. So I was just appalled to hear that.
Yeah, and help me understand, Barb, why that appalls you.
Well, I guess I'm actually up in Door County right now, and I can't, you know, these little resort towns, an armored vehicle coming in with all these, you know, good people, tourists. It just scares me. It's like a horror movie or something. I don't know.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, you may not know. Go ahead, Nick.
Oh, I was going to say, according to a recent report on the militarization of police from the ACLU that was released just a little while ago, something like 500 law enforcement agencies have received these MRAP vehicles or these armored vehicles that are designed to, you know, protect troops against mines. And, you know, this is a kind of good example of where what, you know, what exactly is the function of that to give to local law enforcement when there is absolutely no conceivable need or really desire on the part of the citizenry for that? Police will always accept new toys, especially when they are given for free, or at least, you know, kind of for free at the beginning, and then you take over the maintenance or whatever. But it is, you know, it's troubling. And a lot of the times these tanks are essentially used, or these armored vehicles are parked in, you know, kind of conspicuous places. And it changes the attitude of, you know, of a community. It changes the temperament. That ACLU report, which is online at ACLU.org, also talks about how, you know, with the military hardware comes a kind of militarized attitude. And again, the problem with that is both a lack of real training, but even more than that is that it's a shift from the basic function of police work, which is not about treating people as if, you know, you're in occupied France, but rather, you know, it's a very different relationship. And I think that the militarizing of it gets in the way of the type of police work that actually creates less crime and a better community.
Let's take another call from Dave in Beloit. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how you doing? I was a police officer for 15 years, the last five as a patrol sergeant, and I agree with about 25% of what your guest has to say. First of all, I do find it objectionable when I see police officers dressed in normal patrol gear, as if they're a death squad from some banana republic. That sets people off. I think it gives them a negative impression. I do think officers need to go back to more of a community-style policing. However, the real impetus for upscaling, if you will, police hardware, there was an incident about 30 years ago when I was a police officer where FBI agents were pretty much outgunned and gunned down in a bank robbery situation out east because the bank robbers had fully automatic weapons. That's when the switch from wheel guns, revolvers, six shooters, to semi-automatic pistols or handguns occurred. And then there was another about 20, 25 years ago out in Los Angeles where, again, bank robbers, not drug dealers, had fully automatic weapons. So what police have tried to do is increase their weaponry as the bad guys, if you will, have increased theirs in response so that they don't go into a war zone with pea shooters. And there is a place for military-grade weapons, and that is when there is civil unrest, when there's rioters, when there's looting.
You know,
okay?
What
and
about-
I would like to know, one last thing I would like to know, What do you mean by demilitarizing?
Well, I also, though, want to ask you, Dave, what about Sturgeon Bay having two of these armored vehicles, you know, in a sleepy little resort town?
That is a good question to ask, and I would ask it, too, if I was up in Sturgeon Bay. Why do you need two of these? Okay, I would think one for multi-jurisdictional use in case there is civil unrest would be appropriate. You're not going to send, you should not send squad cars into a civil unrest situation. They're going to get tipped over. They're going to have Molotov cocktails thrown at them, et cetera. A military-grade vehicle is impervious to that kind of civil unrest.
All right, thanks, Dave, because we have short time here. Nick, what exactly do we mean by demilitarizing our police departments?
Well, I think one of the things is stopping the flow of, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars over the past 30 years of military-grade equipment, kind of without any real oversight to local police departments. I mean, there should be a clearer coordination of at what level is this stuff going, because it's clear that, you know, people, and this is something where a lot of liberals and a lot of conservatives actually tend to agree that, you know, the police, because the police function of the state is a totally legitimate and necessary function. We don't hold it to the same level of kind of accounting scrutiny we might other types of programs, but we need to be doing that. It should not be that every you know, police department, every local police department gets what they want or what we might be able to give them, irrespective of demonstrated need or past history. So I think, you know, part of it is that, of just stopping the automatic flow of goods and money coming out of the Pentagon, essentially, and the federal government towards local police. But then it's also having a larger conversation about what is the function of police and what are the different levels of law enforcement, because it is true, you know, that rioting and looting, that calls for a different response than when you're going in to investigate a crime or even stopping a crime in the act of commission or pursuit. So, you know, we need to have a stronger understanding of what are the various levels at which certain types of things get triggered and whatnot. And then finally, the other thing I would just add to, you know, and I thank the caller for his comments and his experience, we also need to get away from the idea that because, you know, there were two or three major events, you know, and I can remember particularly that L.A. shootout where it was, you know, guys walking around a car just shooting the hell out of each other. I mean, thousands of rounds were expended in a very short period of time. You know, that is not, you know, these outlier events should not be what are dictating everyday policy in completely different circumstances. So, you know, we need to be having this conversation. And I mean, if Ferguson is bringing us any kind of positive benefit, it is precisely that we're finally having this conversation about something. Unfortunately, you know, it's been going on for 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, we have just a minute to go. A closing statement on why, where do you want to see this conversation lead?
You know, where I want it to see is on both sides is a growth of mutual respect. One of my former colleagues who's now at the Washington Post, Radley Balco, has written a lot about militarization of police, and he wrote a book called Rise of the Warrior Cop, which is kind of the benchmark for this. It came out last year. In talking with him, he said, you know, one of the things that we need to remember is that police abuse is more visible now than ever because everybody has a camera in their arm. And actually, some police departments, and I've written about this at time, you know, policemen should be wearing wearable cameras or body cams when they're interacting with the public. It provides a semi-objective record of what's going on, and it can really help clarify and minimize a lot of tensions. There are studies that suggest this, and dash cams also do the same thing. But police brutality or police misconduct seems more visible now, but there's every reason to believe that it's actually less than it used to be, partly because cops are better trained and they are more visible, and they know they're being filmed, and people know they...
Yeah, we got to leave it there. We're out of time. Thanks very much for being with us. The news is next. The Ferguson Police Department was heavily criticized for using excessive force and military-style equipment, including body armor, short-barreled assault rifles, and armored vehicles, to quell protesters after the shooting death of an unarmed black teen. Supporters say that police need to do whatever they can to maintain peace. But our big question today is, should law enforcement agencies be allowed to use military-type gear for everyday policing? Do you think that police departments are overly armed, are too militarized? We heard from a guest in our first half hour who said yes, and we were hoping to hear from a guest in this half hour who was going to say that no, it was appropriate for our police departments to have military style gear. But we have not reached that guest yet. But let me as we attempt, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Well, I see that we have reached out and received and contacted our guest from the previous half hour, Nick Gillespie, the editor-in-chief at Reason.com and Reason TV. And we appreciate you joining us for this half hour as well, or at least part of this half hour, Nick Gillespie. We were scheduled to talk with Eugene O'Donnell, who is a professor at the City University of New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He had a conflict with an interview on C-SPAN or CNN or something, and thought he was going to be done by 7:30, but perhaps was delayed. You know, at the end of our last hour, I was asking you what you hoped was going to happen now that we're having this conversation over the militarization of our police departments. And I guess I don't know if you were able to conclude your thought. What is it that you would like to see happen now that we're talking about this?
best thing, I think that the best thing that can be happening is happening, which is that we're starting, it's kind of a hackneyed phrase, but a national conversation about what is the role and responsibility of local law enforcement versus larger other types of law enforcement agencies. And I think that's all to the good. For me, as much as the Ferguson incident, which is at the center of this, I mean, there are a couple of issues there. One is the exact traffic stop or the exact incident which ended with Michael Brown being as an unarmed an unarmed person dead, and there is not we don't know, the investigation has not really begun or certainly not concluded, so we don't know exactly what happened there. But there's that and the issues that raises over police conduct, particularly with a racial overlay, and we need to deal with that, and there are ways to do that. And again, going back to what I was talking about, the ubiquity of cameras and the ability of cops to wear body cams and whatnot, I think there's a lot to talk about there, because there are studies that have shown that when police wear cameras, both the use of force incidents go down, but also complaints go down tremendously. In Rialto, California, for instance, there was a study that was admittedly done by Taser, which is selling a body cam for cops, but they saw really good results over a very quick period of time. So there's that, and then there's the larger question of the response after the protests over this shooting started up, and that's really where we get to the question of militarization on a larger scale. What is the proper way? We spend a lot of money on police. We continue to spend more and more money on police. What is the proper role, and what is the proper role of oversight for police? And I think we're doing that now.
Yeah, but you are not necessarily saying, or are you, that let's take these MRAPs away from police departments. Let's not let the police departments have this military-style equipment.
No, actually, I mean, I am. I think, one of the things that has been going on at least since 9/11 is that there has been a really big free flow of military-grade equipment going literally from the Pentagon or from the federal government to local law enforcement, generally irrespective of need. These are programs where it was very easy for a long time for local police departments to kind of apply for things, or even to have, certain types of weaponry and certain types of vehicles and certain types of body armor and other types of equipment given to them either for free or reduced prices. That really should be, that should probably not be happening on any level. There needs to be a clearer oversight. And we really do need to make a distinction between, the military and even paramilitary type organizations and local law enforcement. They serve different functions, and when you start blending them, you get into a real problem. And I was citing an ACLU report from earlier this year that talked about that with militarized gear and garb, comes militarized attitudes. And, if you are a peacekeeping force or if you're an occupying force, that's very different than if you're a local cop. And if you are a local cop and you start acting like you're a member of an occupying army, that's going to degrade your relationships with the local community, and it's going to lead to more problems rather than fewer problems.
Nick Gillespie, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Nick Gillespie is the editor-in-chief at Reason.com and Reason TV. We have found our scheduled guest for this half hour. Eugene O'Donnell is a professor at the City University of New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He was an officer in the New York Police Department, a prosecutor with the district attorney's offices in Brooklyn and Queens, and a police academy instructor. Good morning.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. I know you were being interviewed by another media outlet just before this. Well, you just heard Nick Gillespie from Reason saying that that we our local police departments don't need to be don't need to be armed like armies. What's your response to that?
Well, if I could just circle back and so say that, remember, this is our system. This is our police force. That the work they do is different than what civilian society does, that it's a force-oriented organization, that they do that in our name, they're our surrogates, that we operate a brutal criminal justice system, and that this idea that we're all bystanders to this and we don't have ownership of this is at the conversation of the last few days. We're seeing is a collapse of.
Well, we're losing our guest on the cell phone, so we are going to take that scheduled break that we always take at this time and make sure that we can hear Eugene O'Donnell. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Are police too militarized? That's today's big question. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Eugene O'Donnell. He is a professor at the City University of New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice, a former police officer, prosecutor, a police academy instructor. And he says, that police are not too militarized. And he's telling us why. And, go on, Eugene O'Donnell. I'm sorry we lost you on the cell phone and not having luck today. But tell us why police departments need to have this military-style equipment like body armor, short-barreled assault rifles, armored vehicles.
Yeah, no, and I never said the police are not too militarized. The issue, just the fundamental issue we have to confront, and especially since it's been on the front burner the last few days, is that the police do use force on people. And they use force on people in our name. They're our surrogates. And they're in the beginning part of a brutal system called the criminal justice system, which has a giant footprint in our country. And the conversation has to be done in terms of the politics, the political establishment, and the need to engage people. These are not weapons that just show up at police departments. There's a process in which they got there. And the idea that I see U.S. senators now claiming shock to find out police departments are getting these weapons. And why would police departments getting these weapons? I'm talking to you from Chicago today, where there's a ongoing hostage situation before I came on the air. We had the events of Boston. We had the events of New York. I was in New York on 9/11 when we didn't know the scope of that attack, how long it would go on for, who was involved. We need to have a nuanced, intelligent conversation about this. I understand there is a significant number of people that wish we didn't need the police, that wished everything could be resolved nonviolently. It's a wonderful impulse, a libertarian impulse. But if you have an active shooter in a school and the police respond and he's shooting the staff and the children, people are going to want to know, and politicians are going to be asked, why is it that you do not provide the equipment to the police? So there's real legitimate issues about this. But as with Ferguson, we have to stop acting like we're bystanders here. We have 100% ownership of this system, and the things the police do are done in our name. And in terms of Ferguson for a moment, We have legislative factories in this country churning out more opportunities for conflict every day with the police. Congress does it all the time. We have no repeal of any laws. We keep adding them. And then we profess to be shocked when there's a bad outcome in a situation in which the police have been moved forward by us to confront people.
Yeah. We have lots of callers, so let's see what Steve in Ashland would like to ask or say. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. I'd just like to say every police officer has the right to go home at the end of the day, just like every soldier does. And when they complained about not having enough body armor, what it took to do the job in Iraq and Iran, you know, how come we are denying the people that keep us safe in our country every day anything or armchair quarterbacking any of the equipment they use?
A response or a reaction, Eugene?
Well, there's no question we have to be careful in acquiring this equipment. It can change the equilibrium. We've got 18,000 police departments. There's clearly police departments that probably shouldn't even be in business. They're scary police departments. We have to have some oversight, and we probably are in denial if we think it can be done by two people, town councils. So there's some serious questions, but it's a nuanced set of issues that are going to require tough political decisions. If you give weapons, you can have a bad outcome, and if you deny organizations weapons, and not we're spending a lot of time on the weapons. This is equipment, so they're getting defensive equipment, and they're also getting equipment such as helicopters in some places. And it's not new; it's been going on for a long time. But the police use force. Hopefully, they can nonviolently resolve things. Sometimes they use a little bit of force. Sometimes they use a lot of force. It is done in our name, and we are the ones who send them out there, and we have to stop pretending that we are, you know, shocked at that. That's not to minimize the obvious issue that there's some police abuse and some underlying issues there, but what I'm seeing in Ferguson, I'm astounded at. From the White House on down, they were making this into a police issue. The disinvestment in these communities, the abandonment of people, the festering issues that have nothing to do with the police. We have the criminalization of drugs. We have a broken mental health structure. We have failures of leadership across the board. And we're talking about a patrolman, the acts of a patrolman, which obviously there should be justice not only done but appear to be done. But to boil down the serious issues in this country and the number of places like Ferguson into a police-citizen interaction in terms of how that was handled or not handled is irresponsible. Yeah. And we're letting ourselves off the hook. I'm sorry to continue. Go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, and many would agree that we need to have those conversations on all those social issues that you mentioned that contributed to what we have been witnessing the past week or more. But I mean, is there really anything wrong with looking into, well, wait a minute, a lot of people thought that the police department's response to the protests and the military style equipment and tactics that we witnessed made it worse. And maybe a lot of the public wasn't aware that so many police departments were getting this equipment.
Yeah, because we should not be having any of these conversations in a vacuum. Policing does not take place in a vacuum. The story, remember, in Ferguson initially was police overreaction. Within 24 hours, the story in Ferguson was police underreaction. There were people complaining, store owners complaining, saying they had to get their own guns because they felt unprotected. And for the police to get the balance right is exquisitely difficult. And this is rightfully talked about in terms of overreaction. But remember the course of underreaction in a situation in which there are people coming there to cause destruction in a community they don't even live in. Yeah. That will endure for decades. Some communities will never recover. So there has to be a balance. And the police have to be pragmatic. And please, let's make this an ideology-free zone, not try to make all of the police decision-making fit into our placement on the political spectrum. We have to be pragmatic and legal. Again, I understand there's a libertarian impulse to not want to confront some of these issues. But I think most people recognize these are issues that have to be looked at square in the eye, even as we're sort of reluctant to do that.
Teresa in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Thank you for your program. I enjoy it. I am what I consider pretty darn conservative, but I don't know if it has to do with my being brought up in a military family. But I see nothing wrong with people who are meant to serve the community in a protective mode being equipped properly. The problem comes when they are not trained properly. You tend to overreact out of fear, and if they could be trained properly not to overreact but to know that they've got protection, then they are less likely to behave in the way they have in Ferguson.
Eugene?
Well, the police need to be trained better. They're pretty rudimentarily trained in this country. But, let's not do a dodge. Police, we had this in New York City where I was this summer. A police officer says to somebody legitimately, assuming they do, have probable cause to make an arrest, you're under arrest, and the person, and I don't want to talk about that particular case, other than it is give some clues to what the police deal with. Somebody says, I'm not coming along. And obviously we hope the police will use nonviolent methods, talk people into this. It would really be helpful if we as a society asked them to do a lot less than we've asked them to do. But there is no magic training at this point to get somebody into custody in a way that's going to satisfy people. And I think the video cameras that are depicting what the police do make us uneasy, because it's done in our name, and there is no magic way to do it. Using force is ugly, and it's unpredictable. And the only sure way to reduce use of force is to reduce the footprint of the police, which we as a society are growing every single year. We have more statutes and more requirements for the police to confront people and to have conflict. And if anybody thinks there's any training, and we need that better training, but that there's some magic training that's going to make an adversarial job where police officers carry deadly weapons around work, that's not the case.
Very briefly, Nick Gillespie was calling on police officers to be required to wear cameras on their lapels. Very briefly, what's your reaction to that?
That the police will initially resist and then they will embrace them. And I think the public is not going to be happy when they're on the receiving end of being on a camera. I think it's also, if we're going to go down that road, I think we should put cameras on everybody, judges, lawmakers. Let's have full accountability and transparency. And I think the unstated issue with cameras is the issue that is not this week's issue, but it's an issue for many of your listeners and people in the country, which is trying to get the police involved in their lives when they need them, when they haven't had a good night's sleep in 2 years because there's a noise complaint. What will the police do in an atmosphere in which they're going to be criticized no matter what they do? It seems to me if there's trouble on 11th Street, you're going to see a lot of the police on 12th Street. So we have to deal with that reality. And that's why these studies show, I don't want to dismiss them and I don't want to minimize it, and cameras can be used to train. But the likelihood, I would imagine, is that there'll be a reduction in complaints because there'll be a reduction in engagement of issues that people are calling the police about nonstop in many places.
Yeah. We have just a minute to go, so some final remarks on at least the push from a congressman to stop this program that sends surplus military equipment to local police departments.
I think Senator Paul, the Libertarian, blamed Washington. He said, how did this happen? What could have happened? Across the board, Congress failed to do its job, obviously. Punted, gave this to the Department of Defense, and inadequately did oversight. And why was that? Because no elected official wants to be caught out in a situation where there is an attack, terrorism or some other attack, in which people are going to start to ask the other question, which is, how were the police not able to stop somebody in, for example, an active shooting situation? So let's have elected officials own these, and let's make them make these difficult decisions, which they apparently are all too good at pushing all the way down, even, unfortunately, from the White House, all the way down onto the role of a police officer. That's where the conversation is for the last few days.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us. Eugene O'Donnell is a professor at the City University of New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice. In our first half hour, we heard from Nick Gillespie, editor-in-chief at Reason Magazine. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Justin Williams for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.